we could look at them. If you need to move them now, that's fine. If you were willing to hold on to them for till we get the initial building. Oh, they're in your car, so they gotta take them out. So okay, fine. So absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
So we should make a time.
Maybe sometime when before or after davening or something like that.
You're saying on a future night.
Is that a good time to come? Like,
it's usually okay. I give a shiur right after davening tomorrow night, but maybe
about what time would it be?
Wednesday
done?
Night.
Oh, I mean, could I hear the shiur?
Oh yeah, the shiur is right after
tomorrow.
Yeah, it's open to everybody.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right. What time is it?
It's right after that, so around 7:45. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that would be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
It's already recording.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Very, very honored and excited again to have Rabbi Chaim Jachter with us. Before I introduce him, tonight's shiur is sponsored in part by Eileen and Jeffrey Hubin, in memory of our longtime members, Charlotte and Mal Rosen, Aleihem HaShalom, at the time of Charlotte's first yard site. It's also sponsored in part by Lisa and Michael Schatz, in memory of Mike's father, David Schatz, Aleihem HaShalom, the Neshama Shehav and Aliyah from the Torah we're going to learn tonight.
Elizabeth also donated to us sponsorship for this week.
Thank you also. Rabbi Jachter, in addition to writing a number of books, including Reasons to Believe, which is available over there, part of which we'll hear about tonight, the Gray Matter books on halacha. Rabbi Jachter also has an international reputation as a get administrator, is a consultant for Community Erevin, is a dayan in the Beis Din of Elizabeth, New Jersey, the rabbi of Congregation Shari Ora in Teaneck, New Jersey, and of course is also a teacher at Torah Academy of Bergen County in New Jersey. Many of my friends are alumni of TABC and rave about Rabbi Jachter's shiurim and his expertise in so many different areas of Jewish thought and halacha. So we're very honored again to hear from Rabbi Jachter. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Jachter. Okay, you see I'm wearing a jacket and a tie, right? Okay, good. Now.
Especially tomorrow. I'm going to be inspecting the air in Cambridge. It's a good day tomorrow to do it, right? It's going to be like 150, something like that.
Got used to without being the jacket and the tie. The reason why I like to take off the jacket and tie is because I don't like to give shiur. I like to engage in battle. So so please, bring it on, you know, if you have something to say. But before I start, I just wanted to say that I know you said that, you're very honored to have me, you're excited to have me. I'm giddy with excitement to be here. I just want to tell you why. It'll take me about 45 minutes, but I'll try to be really, really brief about why I'm so giddy of excitement. So I spent the summer of July 1985 here, and it was Rabbi Soloveitchik's last summer that he was running the summer kollel, and the Halfingers hosted me. And David Zimbel and I, so good to see you, right? was learning with me in Chavrusa in the evening program, and we used to go Friday night to the Epstein's, right, for the Friday night meal, and it's just so incredible to be here. Mrs. Halfinger sent me an email. She said, "Oh, she was so excited that I'm going to be here." So it's really, really, really beyond. I'm so giddy in excitement to be here. But I'm the real, beyond that, I'm also very excited also because I was a couple of weeks ago looking at the Washington, D.C. area. We're also probably in about 190 degrees weather over there. And I saw I spent Shabbos with Eliezer Halfinger. And he was telling me that there's a new building So all I was coming here, so how am I going to recognize? Where am I going to know? I said, oh, and I was so excited. No, it's not a new building. Oh, I'm so happy. I came in here. I was like, oh, my goodness. And I sat by my old seat there by the American flag. You know, it was very exciting. But I hear I should savor the moment because not going to be when he's starting construction tomorrow. No, in the fall. Okay, good. It should be with Mazel. Oh, wow, so it was really good timing to be here to get one last enjoyment that way. Okay, so but let's get to the point. So this year really started in even before 1985. It started in 1978. And I was 15 years old, and like every good yeshiva high school student, you go somewhere for a midwinter vacation. God forbid to stay home. A terrible, horrible thing to do. So I went to my sister's in Los Angeles Friday night. It was Parshas Bo, I think, or Va'era, one of the 10 Makos Parshas. And I went to davening with my brother-in-law, and the rabbi there was speaking about the 10 Makos. And why the need for the 10 Makos, right? Why did Hashem have to make 10 Makos? Pretty clear from the Chumash. Is there to publicize God was there? The Ramban explained. There was a lot of skepticism. And God needed to clarify things. Now, my brother-in-law is very scientifically oriented, still is. He's a statistics professor in Southern California. So he asked me the following very powerful question. Why doesn't God come down and make the same 10 Makos today? After all, you have plenty of skeptics. But boy, in 2018, you have a lot more than in 1985. You have some really aggressive skeptics around today. So why doesn't God today make 10 Makos or announce himself? And I even have an idea of how to do it. My thought would be, is maybe what Hashem should do is during halftime of the Super Bowl, right? So, you can announce, be much better than whatever halftime shows that they show, they have the always very mediocre. Anyway, but they, Hashem should call it. Now that I have everybody's attention, everybody's watching, let me clarify. I'm here. I'm involved with the world. I love the Jewish people. I gave them the Torah. And the Torah is right. It's the right way. Why doesn't God do that? Why doesn't God just make that straight out announcement and make it? You know, it doesn't have to do it every year. You could just do it in the years that the Super Bowl ends in, what is it, X or something? You know that, right? So the LXs are there. You know what I mean. So why does it? It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have. It doesn't have to. Why doesn't God do this? Why doesn't God do this? All right, so let's. I'm going to share with you a few answers, but let's see offhand what would your answer be? Don't worry about being wrong. It's not going to be on the test. That's the best thing about adult education. No tests, right? So what's who wants to give? Who wants to share an answer? Ah.
To test us.
Okay. In other words, because it would be so obvious. That's a good answer, right? Because it would be so obvious. It wouldn't be a challenge. It's not a challenge. You haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of believing in Hashem because it was so obvious. What's a challenge? There's no mitzvah. Good answer. What else? Go ahead.
I have two answers. The jocular answer is that no one would believe that it was really God.
Oh, there we go. Right. There'll always be some skeptic. Right. Can I comment on that for 2 seconds? You know, Eliyahu, who was really convinced that all I need to do is make it absolutely clear to everybody that God is here? And everybody will change in 5 minutes. Who's that? Eliyahu HaNavi, at Mount Carmel, Har Carmel, right? And he made this whole incredible show, and he davened, Aneni Hashem Aneni. Aneni Hashem Aneni. Right? He said twice. Why? So the first one answered me, come down with a fire, make it clear. And then he said Aneni again so that the cynics don't say, oh, yeah, he was faking it. Right? Okay, so that's right.
So
you always got some cynic.
Other answer, yeah. Not so quite so jocular, is that
this is a good answer.
It would be such that we are supposed to perform its vote because of our love of God.
Oh, there we go.
And if God were to display himself to us, we might be now doing the mitzvot out of fear and not out of love.
Okay. Okay, I hear that. Okay, I'm gonna develop that a little bit. Let's get some more answers. Yep.
Yeah, go back to Eliyahu. Yeah. Go to the next episode where he gets fired in the cave.
That's right.
Right. And right below, Eishes Hem below.
Right.
Hashem, right. Kol Dimama Daka. It's
right.
Steady.
Oh, very good. Kol Dimama Daka.
Medrash.
Right. Right. Hashem is not about the open miracles. It's about the subtle miracles. Right. And that's right. That's really answers right over there. So that's in Kings 1, chapter 19. That's a best answer. That's good. All right, we can go home now. We have a little more than that. That's a great answer. Also, by the way, another answer based on that whole episode is what happened. Does anybody remember what happened after Eliyahu convinced everybody? Right, the fire came down. Everybody said what? Hashem Elokim, like we said, Yom Kippur, Hashem Elokim, Hashem Elokim. Everyone's all excited, right? And then what happened the next day?
He's running for his life from Yizevel.
He has to run from his life from Yizevel. How come everybody didn't protect him from Yizevel?
Because they didn't change that much.
Oh, that's right. You know, it's like Yizevel said, all right, tomorrow. Remember that? She says, tomorrow I'll go kill him. Why say tomorrow? They're all excited today when she heard about what happened at Hara Carmel. Yeah, they give them one day, they'll calm down, they'll go back to where they were, and unfortunately, that's cynics. Talk about the cynics. It's true. It's true. Even in the big open miracles, yeah, whoa, that's wow, it's unbelievable, right? But the next day, you just go back to where you were, right? So that's a good...
It happened 40 days after Mount Torah.
After Mount Torah, right. The Har Carmel only took them a day. Yeah, at least it took them 40 days. Right. These are also great answers. Let's hear anybody want to answer. Yes, go ahead.
So, I mean, I'm not sure this really would explain a why or a why not, but you have... It's not. I don't think the question is a contrast between great open miracles at the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim and today, where you don't really, at least obviously, see any. Because throughout Tanakh, you have a gradual decreasing.
Ooh.
In open miracles. So even very good. The river goes up into a column and they cross the river, but that's nowhere near as impressive as crossing the Red Sea.
Uh-huh.
So without nearly as many miracles described
right.
there, you know. And then even later on, a great miracle happens. I forget who I think it was. Sancheirav is turned back.
Right, Sancheirav. That's right.
What open miracle was it? Oh, everybody died overnight.
Right.
Not fire came down from heaven.
Okay, very good. Hashem's weaning us off of the open miracles. Okay, very good. The question is how do you interpret those? Okay, very good insight. But why would Hashem want to? Very impressive. Why would Hashem want to wean us off open miracles? Let's go ahead.
At Har Sinai, the people said, "We're scared."
Moses, it's too much.
Moses, we can't listen anymore. Even though we were alive.
Still, right.
But we're going to die if we hear anymore. So
okay.
So and it refers to it several times that Moses goes back to the idea that. The people would accept a Navi, that would be some kind of minister,
right.
Herald, whatever.
Right, someone in the middle, right, okay.
So maybe that also says we don't want to go back to that stage.
It's too much, it's a little too intense. Okay, can I run with that? Let me run with that a little bit. I thought the typical answer, usually people will give the answer of that, and I'm sure you're all thinking of this. That if Hashem would make an open miracle, then what would we not have? We wouldn't have? Right. I'm so glad you're saying that, because we spend a lot of time learning about free will back in 1985. That's right. In the Rambam, Hilchos Teshuvah. So this you wouldn't have free will, right? So, okay, right? You wouldn't have a choice. So what's the downside of not having free will? What's that? Why is it so bad not to have free will? Question is how you interpret that also. When someone interprets that, Meshach Chachman wants to interpret that to mean that the mountain over our head means that it was as if figuratively, it's figuratively because it was so obvious we didn't have a choice. What kind of a choice do you have if it's so obvious that God was there? So it's as if God held a mountain over our heads because we really didn't have much of a choice. So let's see what might be some other downsides of there being an open miracle. a downside, what might be, not only that we wouldn't get reward, because what reward is if there's no challenge, we mentioned that before, but there's something else. I like to interpret based on a sefer that, being the rabbi of the Sephardic congregation, Sephardim really love this sefer. They read it every, I think Hasidim also do it, every Friday before Shabbos. And what's that? Shir HaShirim, right? And what's Shir HaShirim? It's a what? It's an, right? Traditionally, it's understood as an allegory to our relationship between us and Hashem, right? So we're comparing the relationship between us and Hashem to a husband and wife. Okay, very nice. So that to a relationship. Now that's very, very fundamental. That Hashem wants to have a relationship with us. It's, you know, the biggest mistake that we make, if I can just deviate for a second, the biggest mistake that I think that we make in terms of our relationship with Hashem is that we think that we, and the way we educate our children, right, we think it's all about obedience, right? Oh, you better keep Shabbos or else you're going to get zapped, right? You better sit in the sukkah. Who knows what's going to happen to you, right? You know, that's the, a lot of times we have the same relationship with Hashem as we do the IRS. You know what I'm saying? You know? Just compliance. That's it, right? But that's not, it's relationship. The IRS is not interested in a relationship. Trust me, they're not interested in a relationship with us. They just want compliance. But Hashem is not the IRS, right? It's it's about a relationship. So if it's about a relationship, why do you need free will? Because without free will, you don't have a relationship, right? I'm gonna give you an example. I mean, I have everybody here, I hear all kinds of stories about nice proposals, right? And I've never heard of a proposal that went like this. Take out a gun and say, okay, either marry me or I shoot, right? Why would that not be a very good relationship? Because that's, there's no choice. There has to be a choice. In order to be a relationship, there has to be a choice. So, therefore, what's the downside of Hashem? If Hashem would announce himself, so obviously, what would be the downside? We wouldn't have a choice. If you don't have a choice, you don't have, you don't have that kind of a relationship. And there's a stunning implication of this point. Think about this. In a certain way, who might have a better relationship of us and Hashem? Who have a better relationship with Hashem? Us today, or our ancestors at either biological or ideological at Sinai? Who had a better relationship? Who had a stronger relationship according to this approach that we're saying? We do, right? Because why? Because our ancestors at Sinai was, what were they told? What was their proposal, right? Either accept it or else, right? As we were doing when the Gemara, right? You didn't have much of a choice. So what kind of a relationship is that? But for us, we have a choice. So our relationship really can be richer. So I think that's really what you were driving at, where you were saying, right? Because you're saying, where can there be that love, right? It would just be about you're about compliance, obedience, yeah.
It is, however, I would say that in a way the prohibitions are the same to us. You know, the penalties for doing things are the same that they were when the Torah was given, right? I mean, you know, there are heavenly penalties. The penalties aren't having to, if we don't do a negative commandment, the
right.
Penalties are the same.
Right.
Okay. We just view them differently. We say, oh, you know, I can do tshuva and nothing is really going to happen to me, right? That's our way out of not being perfect human. I mean, nobody can be a perfect human being, but
as long as we're trying our best, as long as we're right.
But if we do an avera, right? We don't see that ramification of what we don't have Miriam sitting in front of us getting leper tsaros, right? We don't have that anymore,
right?
Right. So I don't know that our relationship is better or stronger. It's just different.
Okay, that's interesting. That's interesting. That's right. An interesting way of looking at it. But it's certainly, you know, it's the fact that we don't have a Miriam getting tsaras, or anybody getting tsaras in front of us, right? Which has just made it so obvious that you shouldn't speak Lashon Hara. If you choose not to speak Lashon Hara now, it's a choice. It's a very legitimate choice, and it really can transcend just simple obedience, and it hopefully gets to the point of recognizing that all of these prohibitions in the Torah are there for our benefit, and also building up the relationship. You know, the married folks, we everybody knows the prohibitions, with a lot of prohibitions, right? You better not forget to get a present on your anniversary, or else you'll be in big trouble, right? It's all about the relationship. It's all about the relationship. So, and on our best interests. But it's great discussion. Yes.
How does God's announcing that Nietzsche was wrong at the Super Bowl take away our free will?
Oh, very good. I like that. I was saying Nietzsche. I should add that to the script. Okay, good. I was going to say Richard Dawkins, right? Richard Dawkins, whatever. But I got you. That's much better. So, right. So the downside with doing that is that it just makes it, where's the choice anymore? Where's the choice?
People in Tanakh do avert all the time. And
right.
Especially even if God just spoke to them.
So I'll share with you why, right? Why was there, why did people in Tanakh, even though God spoke with them, why were they doing averos? Because the Yetzer Hara, the volume on the Yetzer Hara was a lot higher, right?
Okay,
God always creates an even playing field.
Right.
Oh, I hear what you're saying,
so
right?
Why today? Why not have open miracles and a stronger Yetzer Hara?
Oh, I hear. But we already requested. We don't want that. We turned down the volume there. Remember the Gemara in Yoma?
Because an even playing field doesn't matter.
I hear. But the playing field changes every once in a while. It's kind of like Canadian football, 110 yards, 100 yards. Right. Anyhow, yes.
Different direction is that there is a need, I think, to recognize how impossible it is to completely comprehend what God's intention is or what He wants.
Okay.
So the idea of making it so that we have to be looking, we have to be curious.
Oh, okay, right.
And we have to be
a seeker of God.
A seeker, and also a humble seeker.
Because
the idea that if you know, God says, this is exactly who I am, this is exactly what I want, we're not going to be able to understand that because our capacity to fully grasp it is limited.
Right.
So the idea of thinking that we know is a dead enemy of the truth in this kind of an endeavor. And I think that it's possible that a deeper understanding can come from recognizing how little we're able to comprehend the fullness of whatever God's intentions are.
Right. Okay, you remind me of a statement that's made by one of my favorite people. He lives here in Boston. Dr. England, Dr. Jeremy England. Did you ever meet him? Right? Very, very impressive person. And there's a nice short video of him on Orthodox. It's called Orthodox Jewish All Stars. I love that little video. And he said that, oh my goodness, he had such a wonderful line where he says that you start meeting God when you recognize your limitations and recognize what you don't know. So that's that fits with what you're saying as well. I like to break open this, David.
So here you're saying about free will and the importance of that. What do you do with the idea in the Gemara that somebody who performs a mitzvah that he's obligated to do comes out with a greater reward than somebody who voluntarily...
Oh, so I'm saying that I'm making us volunteers.
Yeah,
right. Right. Well, that's a good question. Okay. So remember, the Gemara is this huge debate about who's better off. One that does a mitzvah is a volunteer, right? Or somebody who does a mitzvah because he's commanded to. Right, but the very fact that we still have to recognize and make that choice to recognize that we're commanded. In other words, the command is not blatantly obvious. We still have to choose to recognize we're commanded, right? And once you recognize you're commanded, right, then you're doing this as this relationship is a command. It's obligatory, right? And you gotta have a better relationship, right? Which is a better relationship, a marriage relationship or an engagement relationship? Marriage is my why, because you're, you know, it's a command. Engagement, you can back out, right? But a marriage, you know, that's it. You're committed. You're commanded, and it's a better relationship. See what I'm, but your answer is a great question. It's a great question. I had to think about more. That was like a 5-second answer, but that's off the cuff. That's a great question. It's a great, 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 great question. Yes, Rabbi Strauss.
I guess just playing off what you were saying.
Yeah. This is a good audience. Oh, my goodness. This is a strong audience. No, just to come to Boston more often, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
No, just, but spontaneity in a marriage is much, sometimes much harder and much more meaningful.
Right.
To do it.
Right.
Do something spontaneously good and nice. Then.
Oh, so that's a defense. Oh, yeah, we're good. Right. Okay.
Yeah. In other words, because you feel you have to, but at the same time, no one's forcing to.
Right.
Like your relationship will keep going on.
Right.
But you should, you have to, but if you do it,
right.
even with that,
right.
It's been going on a long time, even though I have to, it's like that much more meaningful.
Right. When you get a nice gift for your wife, right, or your husband, right, when it's not your anniversary or something, not a birthday, not occasion, you're doing it, right, so that's fun today. Right, so in other words, that fits into what we're saying. In other words, even there's a command, you know, still there's a bit of that choice, that combination between the two. Okay, great ideas. Oh, unbelievable ideas. Let me try to break open the discussion even to a higher level by quoting someone once told me that Rav Soloveitchik's favorite Risha, favorite medieval authority. Okay, if you were to guess, who is his favorite authority? Who is his favorite Risha? The one who he named the school after, right? Oh. So. No, but somebody told me that wasn't his favorite Rishon. His favorite Rishon was the Ramban. He loved the Ramban. And Rav Lichtenstein also. He loved the Ramban. You know, someone once asked him, if you were stuck on a desert island, you know, and you could only have one sefer, what would you have? He'd say the Ramban on the Torah. Just give me the Ramban on the Torah and some food, and I'm good. You know, so the Ramban on the Torah is unbelievable. And I'd like to share with you the Ramban, what might be the most powerful idea of the Ramban on the Torah. It's his commentary at the end of Bo. It's unbelievable. And he asks, He grapples with our issues. Is why doesn't God make the 10 Makos every 10 years? I don't know. Why doesn't he make it every generation? So he gives an answer, a very, very powerful. All these answers are great answers. Great, great, rich answers. But the Ramban gives an unbelievable answer that just breaks this whole discussion out even beyond what we've done now. Takes it to the next level. He says, and we have to delve really, really parse it and delve into it. So Ramban says, oh, this is such a great idea. He says that instead of God performing the 10 Makos, right? Instead of God performing the 10 Makos, right? Every year, instead, what does he do? Instead, what does he, what's that?
He commands us to.
We tell the story. We tell the story, right? And we publicize it. We tell the story of the 10 Makos, right? Instead of God performing the 10 Makos. So our telling the story of the 10 Makos is instead of God doing it. That's an unbelievable comment. That's my favorite. I hope it'll become your favorite one too. Favorite comment of the Ramban. But what does it mean? What does that mean? All right, anybody want to give a shot? A shot? What does that mean? I mean, you got to digest this. Ramban, it's an amazing Ramban.
It limits.
What's that?
It limits the effect of the makot.
Oh, interesting.
Before the makot, we had to do Ki Mitzrayim, Ki Ani Hashem, but we don't tell Mitzrayim. We're not commanded to become missionaries. We tell each other.
That's interesting. It's a more limited scope. Okay, that's a good point. Maybe also it's not as obvious, so you still have this choice, more subtle. All right, go ahead. Oh, I thought you had that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think there's another reality in this, is that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu did the plagues, they were against Egypt, but it was for the whole world.
And
the whole world heard. So he doesn't have the Egyptians necessarily to do it to, the same Egyptians to do it to anymore. We're not enslaved. But the commandment to make the whole world hear it is the ultimate of the Makkah.
Okay, that's right. So make an announcement.
That's, I think, yeah, what you're saying.
Right.
Right.
Do the equivalent of the 10 Makkos, right?
No, it's more.
Oh, it's the Rambam. Oh, okay, go ahead.
It's really more because when God performed the Makkos, the whole world didn't see them, hear them, know about them. They heard about them.
Oh.
Later.
Oh, that's a good comment.
Right?
That's a good comment.
That's, I think, what the Rambam
I'm glad I came. I'm really glad I came here.
Right.
That's a great comment. A lot of great comments and questions. Oh, boy. This is... yes,
if
go
you
ahead.
Go further in the Ramban.
Yeah.
Right? He says the purpose of open miracles is precisely so we learn to see God's presence in things that aren't open.
Right,
miracles.
Right. Right,
and you don't really get to do that if God keeps coming down and interrupting the Super Bowl.
Right, that's right.
To tell you about Nietzsche and Dawkins and whatever else.
Right, right. Got you.
God doesn't have to, because God wears a T-shirt that says Nietzsche is dead.
Good one. Good one. Okay, well, if he would wear a T-shirt, he would wear that. That's right. Yes, if he would wear a T-shirt, that's what he would wear. That's right. That's right. If he were, that's what he wore. Yes?
Michael's comment just made me think of something that I learned years ago at Ancient Torah. And actually, when you think of that, like, when you think of Abraham, you know, kind of pre-Moshe, like, figuring out sort of on his own
side. Right.
Because of this, you know, maybe it's not the moment, you know, coming to the conclusion that
it's
God. So they made a quote there once, and I remember, you know, it was a center on Green Street, but they made a beautiful quote. One of the rabbis, he said, if you looked at, like, the Prudential Building, and you said, geez, you know, huge building, and you look at the bush in front of it, and the man-made building is so pale in comparison, the bush, he said,
right,
is so much more complicated
right
than the building. So if people took a step back and looked at a piece of nature and said,
right,
wow, what has
you don't need the 10 Makkos, just study biology, right.
Yeah.
That's right. Right. It's a great
then
point.
Like
right. But you have to think. But it's a challenge. It's subtle. Nature is just a great opportunity for Hashem because it's subtle. And a person has to make the choice to think about it and recognize and realize, oh my goodness, and to be overwhelmed by the biology. Great, another great comment. Here's yes.
Similar
as a downside, right?
With Noah, which is
right. Oh, very good. Yeah, that's a good comment.
If Makkos were being repeated, it would be punishment, direct, open view of punishment,
right,
by more people dying.
Right, right.
And
there's a serious downside to that.
It
right.
Is a way to remind you of it, but it only that kind of degree.
It's safer.
Only has
it's safe.
Once.
Right, that's right. It's a safer vicarious experience of the 10 Makkos. Right.
Wow,
another great comment. Another great comment. I would like to share it to you. Go ahead, yes?
But there's a sense in which the point of the Makkos was a lesson in
right.
ruling God's
right.
presence, but also a creation of the Jewish people who accept it
okay.
and then live by it.
Right. Oh, that's where we're going. Okay, where we go. That's where I'm going to take it. It doesn't take away from all these great comments, but we're going to just add on a little bit. So I want to share three ideas. First of all, you have the Ramban, and it just shows you how rich. You understand why the Ramban is unbelievable. Ramban's unbelievable. So I think you might compare. You might be able to understand the Ramban's comment in light of a very important midrash that you've probably heard. But it's really worth bearing mention, right? Rabbi Akiva has a famous debate about who hated Bris Mila, who hated Bris Mila, right? The Romans, the Greeks. Why? Because for them, what right? They venerated nature. They could not they could not wrap their head around Bris Mila. Here you have a very nice baby boy, perfect, right? And all of a sudden, what are you doing? You're improving it. It's like, you know, they tell a story that there was this in the old Yiddish theater they used to have in New York. They used to have one time there was in Yiddish Macbeth by Shakespeare, but improved by Yankel Schwartz. You know what I'm saying? You know, made even better, right? So you know, you can't. Who are chutzpah for, you know, for us to do Bris Mila? That's why the Romans were really against it. So you know, how did Rabbi Akiva respond? Well, he gave them an analogy. He gave them a choice. What would you like to have? He gave you a raw piece of grain and a beautiful baked bread. Which would you want? Right? Of course you want the bread. Right? Even though what? Even though God made the wheat, but we make the bread. And so what's the analogy? That what has God done to human being? God has empowered all humanity, and he gives us the raw material, and what's our job? Our job is to take it to the next level, to improve it. What's a Jewish attitude towards nature? Do we reject it like some religions do? No. Do we embrace it like the ancient Greeks? No. What do we say about nature? Nature is there to be improved. That's the message of Bris Mila, that we are partners with Hashem. He empowers us. He dignifies us. That he does not infantilize us. He treats us like adults. So therefore, what might the idea be that God one time shot 10 makos? Next time in a safe, right? He's given now, that was part of the creation of the Jewish people, as he said so nicely. And now the Jewish people are launched. Now they'll be the ones that will tell the story instead of God performing it. It seems that the Ramban is getting to a sense of partnership. It's part of Hashem partners with us, empowers us. You'll do the rest. I'll provide the raw material, the 10 makos, but then your job is what? Is to publicize it. Going back to Shir HaShirim, right? It's a wonderful pasuk. We say it in Kiddush Levana, right? It's a Hine Zeh Omer Achar Kazlenu. Metzitz Ven Achar Kim. There's God. There's God. He's peering between the lattice work, meaning that God is not going to be subtle. Whose job is it to announce that he's there? We have to choose to discover him. And when you discover him, then our job is, there he is. There he is. Hine zeh omer achar kotleinu. Right? That subtle involvement. Our job is to point it out. So, and it's a dignity that he gives us, a great gift.
Most of my
family is intermarried also. Yeah.
The people
are not
killing.
Right.
Maybe if there were an open miracle, okay, so you take away free will.
Right.
Right. But then maybe you wouldn't have, you know, all of the horribleness that's going on in the world. People felt, you know, Hashem is watching.
But the downside is that, well, it's a choice. The beautiful thing is that every human being has that choice. Every beautiful, and it's interesting, and even if I can bring it into a little bit of a convert, right? Rav Soloveitchik once said in Shir, a beautiful comment, he said that a non-Jew who comes to convert has a right to convert. Okay, we have to be convinced that it's in everybody's best interest to do it, that it's going to last, be something that's not going to be here today and gone tomorrow, but if he has the right to do so, everybody has that choice. Every human being has that choice. And we're not like result. I think What is a pasuk that we say every day in Oh my goodness. Sorry, I've been running around a whole day in the burning hot sun with an Erev. So my with Erev been all over the place. So I'm a little sunburned. Lobimispar, what does Hashem say? Lobimispar. Okay, look tomorrow in davening. You'll see Hashem doesn't matter. He's not interested in numbers. Numbers doesn't matter, right? It's quantity. That's not the issue. It's the quality. And everybody has that choice. You made the choice. I made the choice. I grew up, you know, my family, my mother made the choice. My sister made the choice. And I made the choice, right? My relatives and your relatives, unfortunately, didn't make the choice. But it's a choice. It's a choice. Why do some people behave? I once had a student in school who asked me, how, you know, a very interesting question. Now he's a very, very successful rabbi. He asked me, and when he was a senior in high school, how come I'm much more serious about Torah study than most of my peers? How do you answer that? Made a choice. Now, if God would say, "All right, better learn," you know, you're all done, so then you would have a lot more people complying. But it's not about complying, it's about the relationship, right? So the numbers really, when we're relationship, our goal is relationship, I think the numbers really are not really what are so crucial. Okay? It's a good question. It's a very important question. What's that?
Relationship is two-way. Hashem wants relationship is two-way. Right? So Hashem gave to, you know, people at Mount Sinai, you know, there was their open miracle, all right? And the rest of us, take it or leave it.
So let me jump ahead. Let me jump ahead a little bit of my talk. Why did my mother become, where started the ball got rolling in my family? Why did my mother become religious? Because in the 1967 war, right, this was, you know, my mother came to the conclusion, this is not normal, right? And this shouldn't have happened. And, you know, and she went back to the way that she was brought up, right? She was shook up and by what happened, and she reacted and she changed her life, right? She made that choice. God made it. You study what happened in 1967. You'll see, read Michael Oren's book, right? The 6 days of war. Even if you just read the book, certainly if you live through it in that time, like so many people did, how many people became observant at that point? There were some, but it's a tiny minority. My mother made that choice. Why did other people make that choice? You know, it's something to be thought. God made that opportunity. He gives you opportunities, right? The question, do people seize opportunities? One last point to answer your question. We'll move on a little bit with the Ramban in sports. You can say, I like sports. I have a 10-year-old. I used to hate sports. But I took 30 years off from it. But I have a 10-year-old son who loves sports. So he's gotten kind of like revived me. Okay, anyway. So they say, what's the difference between a great team and a mediocre team? Or a good team and a bad team? What do good teams do? All teams have opportunities. All teams have opportunities. What do the good team and the great teams do? What do? They seize the opportunities. When there's right? Someone, you have a lot of people who do well in business and other people don't do well. There are a lot of explanations. Part of it is that some people seize opportunity. Could be that everyone somewhere along the line has opportunities, but who chooses to seize those opportunities? That's I think the difference. Let's move on to another suggestion. Yes.
I just want to say one thing.
Yeah.
Maybe it's going backwards a little bit, but we're looking at the plagues in only one direction.
Right.
But if you look at the Chumash, I believe what God is really trying to do is send a lesson to Paro. Right? I mean, that's why at the end of the plagues, that's why God is, he gave him free will, and then he said, okay, free will is over, baby. I'm going to harden your heart. I'm going to do this. And it is an object lesson to Paro.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. And so I think you have to bear that in mind.
Okay.
Because it's
a good comment.
It's a double-edged sword. Right, and that may be another reason why we don't have those.
Okay,
I will also.
That's a good point, right?
That
very
I
good.
We do have open miracles today. I think every war that Israel has fought has been an open miracle. I cannot imagine when you think about what those wars were like and who fought them in 1948. Who fought that war for Israel? some veterans, some non-Jewish veterans who went and helped Israel, and 14 and 15 year olds and 20 years old survivors from the camps, and yet they were able to win through overwhelming odds.
Right.
If that is not
the first month of the war is a big time. Right. That's correct. 67, right. The first month of the war, the first month or two of the war, right. That's correct. It shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened. Right. That's correct. The Ramban says that as well. 100%. Let me share with you two other thoughts. And then we'll conclude. I wanted to share with you a story of happened a few years ago in my family. In December of 2014, I believe it was, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in Manhattan had a collection that was called Iberia, From Iberia to Assyria. It was a magnificent exhibit. I don't know if it got here to Boston. And it was a magnificent collection of like all the top archaeological finds from the Near East, collected from some of the top museums all over the world, like an all-star team from all the museums, from the British Museum in London and from the Israel Museum in Yerushalayim and the Louvre, and it was magnificent. And they had I dragged three of my oldest children there, and magnificent. We saw artifacts from the Plishtim, from the Philistines, right? From the Chumash, the Philistines, right? From the Phoenicians, the Sidonim, from the Tanakh, right? From the Babylonians, it's unbelievable. It was remarkable. I said to my kid, my goodness, you have artifacts from all our favorite Rishayim, you know, or all the Egyptians, you know, they're all here, right? So remarkable. But to someone who thinks, like we talk about the things, about the plant, right? The small plant by the building, right? The skyscraper, right? The one who really thinks, right? Who is the really thoughtful, reflective, honest person who would be at the museum on that day, what was the most interesting phenomenon in the museum that day? Not the lunch.
All okay. Those sculptures are gone.
Right. Oh, that's right. You see where I'm going with this. Who really were the most interested? Were the most right? Was my family right? Because I didn't see any Philistine parents bringing their little kids saying, "Hey, you know, look at the artifacts from our right." I didn't see any Babylonians. I didn't see any Assyrians. I didn't see any Phoenicians. I didn't see any ancient Egyptians. I didn't see any of those groups. But yet, the Jews are still around. And not only that, it's the same culture. When we saw on exhibit a bama is like one of these backyard mizbech altars, and private altars. It's, you know, Sefer Melachim, they're always really, really against it in Sefer Melachim. So, and it's on display. And my daughter was, I have a daughter named Atara. She was 11 years old at this time. She saw the Mizbeach, and all of a sudden she became very, very excited. She saw the corners of the Mizbeach. And she said, "Oh, that's what we say, right? That's the Karnos HaMizbeach. Those are the corners of the Mizbeach. Right, there we are. So the corners of the Karnos HaMizbeach." So she was very, very excited. In other words, why am I showing this? Is that the fact that an 11-year-old was able to identify, you didn't need someone to be a PhD in ancient Jewish history was able to identify it. It means the culture is still alive. It's not just the people are still around, the culture is still around. In other words, what might the Ramban be saying? Ramban might be saying that when you think about it, what might even be a greater miracle than the Ten Makos? Rav Yaakov Emden makes this comment in his introduction to his Siddur. What might even be a greater miracle than the Ten Makos? Fact that we tell the story of the Ten Makos, right? Look who's telling the story. We should have been long gone, right? So the story of the war of Israel's War of Independence. And if you really want to delve into it, you have to buy Benny Morris's book called 1948. Learn the story about the 48 War.
learn the story about of the UN vote in 1947 to vote to establish a Jewish state in part of Eretz Yisrael. It shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened. But that's part of a bigger story. We shouldn't be here. By all logic, the fact that we're having this shiur tonight is a miracle. It's a miracle that we're here, that we're talking about these things. This shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be happening. We shouldn't be here. Even people talking about, there was the famous Look magazine within the 60s. It said the vanishing American Jew, right? And the vanishing American, we shouldn't be here. We should have vanished. The American Jews should have vanished. We should have vanished a long, 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 long time ago. Yeah? Yeah, right. So we're here, and the magazine's vanished. That's right. Correct. That's right. Correct. So that's really the remarkable point that the Ramban is saying. I think that's just that's a very powerful. I think it's a very, very powerful idea. I want to give you one last one about this Ramban. One last idea, and that is as follows. The Ramban might be understood also as this, about not just the fact that the miracle of our survival, which the Rav Yaakov Emden says is a great, our survival is, and he wrote this in the 18th century, right? Imagine what we would say today, right? After, right? 3 years after a third of our nation are murdered, right? We come and we were able to win a war, totally outnumbered, totally outgunned on three different fronts. Right, Germany couldn't win a war on two fronts, and we won on three fronts, despite being so out vastly outnumbered, vastly outgunned. Right, and besides this, the miracle of our survival. But here's something else: the fact that the Jews tell this story, the fact that the Jews tell this story, not just our survival, but our very, very nature. Right. How many of you heard of the book Startup Nation? You heard of Startup Nation, right? And so Startup Nation is describing why Israel is very, very is so successful in its entrepreneurial ventures. And if anybody remembers the book, what's the key point? What really drives Israeli culture and Israeli innovation? The fact that everybody has a say. Everybody can be critical. Everybody speaks up, right? And CEOs of companies, they're shocked. They come to Israel and they come and they present their product. What are they shocked about? Remember in the book, when you show up, whenever they show up, everybody's criticizing. Everybody's saying you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong, right? That's the culture. And what is Amos Oz is quoted there saying? Amos Oz, he's well known for being a spiritual, Israel's number one ranked advocate for secularism. And he makes the following comment. He said that it's not surprising that this is the culture in Israeli companies, because what? This is the way our culture has been for thousands of years. For at least 3,000 years, right? Think about it. What other people in what other culture, what other religion have as their second holiest book, right? A book which is, how could anybody summarize the Gemara? What's the Gemara? It's 2,700 pages of what?
Arguments.
Of arguments. That's right. Right? Here. Why, you know, the Rambam once made, you know, as a comment, you know, if something is, if something there's no argument about, it must come from Sinai. Why must it come from Sinai? Because if it wasn't from Sinai, we'd be arguing about it, right? Right? What other people needs four different hashkachot on a bag of potato chips in order to be convinced? Because why? Because we like to, you know, that's what we argue. That's our nature, right? We had in school, one of a teacher who had been teaching in public school, a retired teacher, and he came to teach history. And he said, what's going on here in this place? Every single thing I say, they're arguing with me. And I said, come sit in my class. You know, so he said, oh my goodness, you seem to enjoy that they're arguing with you, right? You know, it's like, so I said, yeah, that's who we are. That's the culture. That's the culture. So, the very, and you know, and it, it's
It's remarkable. It's one other quote from a secular person, but they're not thinking. Shimon Peres. He's quoted in another wonderful book about Israel, Seymour Siegel, called "Let There Be Water." You ever see that book? It's a really good book. It's a wonderful book. And Seymour Siegel writes, and it quotes Shimon Peres saying, "What's the Jewish people's greatest contribution to the world's culture?" He uses one word: dissatisfaction. Ask any president of any shul. Dissatisfaction. Right? That's who we are. It's our culture. So why is that so important? Okay. So if the people who this is our nature, we're argumentative, we're contentious. It's our nature. Why is that so important that we're the people who tell over the stories of the Ten Makos? Right? Why is it that it's important that we're the ones that tell over the story of how our ancestors, biological or ideological, received the Torah at Har Sinai? Right? Because we're the only ones, we're the only culture in the world that has an ongoing tradition of a national revelation or these nationwide miracles like the Ten Makos. Right? So we Jews have been known as all kinds of names. People call us all kinds of names. But what name have we never been called? We've never been called the dumb people, right? We've never been called the foolish people. So someone who you go to a secular university. How will you go to a Bible class? How will they account for the fact that the Jewish people have this ongoing tradition, this live tradition that their ancestors experienced this mass revelation or these miracles that were viewed by an entire nation? How will they explain it? They'll all explain that what? Somebody came and fooled us. Somebody came and fooled us. Somebody came and convinced us that, yeah, a couple thousand years before we had this experience. Somebody fooled us. Now, think about what Shimon Peres said about dissatisfaction. It's what Amos Oz, about our contentiousness and our argumentative. Why is that so important? Why is that so important? Right? And you mean to tell me, Shimon Peres and Amos Oz, you mean to tell me that of all, okay, the only culture in the world that has this ongoing tradition that there was this mass revelation, there's this mass nationwide miracle. The only nation in the world that has this was the one, and why? Because the only nation that was fooled was what? Were the people that, from whom 22% of the Nobel Prizes come from, right? It's unreasonable. An argumentative, contentious people, and yet, we've always been this way. Just look at the Chumash, look how Moshe Rabbeinu was treated. We argumented, we're contentious, and yet we accept it. We're telling the story of the Ten Makos. The fact that the miracle of our survival, and the very fact that such an argumentative, tenacious people have this tradition, to me, it seems to be even better than the Ten Makos. Even better than the Ten Makos. So, and the Ramban also adds, he says, you know what? He also says, points we were making before. There are, what kind of miracles are there? There are two categories of miracles. What are two categories of miracles? Right. Nigla Nistar. Why would we translate? Nigla means open, obvious. And what does Nistar mean? Hidden. Right? The Ramban says there's a in-between category. Right? What's the in-between category? Right? When what the Torah tells us should be happening happens, the Torah said let me give you just a couple of predictions that the Torah makes. It's been fulfilled. It's crazy. Here, Megillas Esther. We have to describe how we narrowly avoided an annihilation. Megillas Esther says, the Jewish people will always be observing Purim, which is implying that what? They're always going to be a people observing Purim, right? Isn't that crazy? It makes a prediction. Shouldn't have happened. The book seems to indicate, the book of Esther seems to be, wow, these people are easily annihilated, and made a prediction, and it happens. The Torah predicts we're going to be exiled and we're going to return. It's unbelievable. Right? All these things, when you see these, when you see this happening, this is, and when you think, and when you think a bit, this is even this is not may not be a violation of the laws of nature. It may not be an open miracle, an obvious miracle, but it's not just quite subtle. He calls like a semi-open miracle. It's sort of like a translation that he gives. So the bottom line is, we've come up with some of my suggestions, the Ramban suggestions, and most important, your suggestions. How many answers do we have for our question that we came up with? Maybe about 10, 15 answers, right, that we've all come up with. Just listen to the recording. I should write it all up. It's a great conversation. But I want just to leave you with the last thought. When my brother-in-law asked me this question back in 1978, I didn't have an answer. I was 15 years old. He's like, I don't know. I don't know. Why doesn't God make the 10 miracles today? I didn't even have an answer. But now, 50 years later, never was any good in math. 40 years later, right, I have some answers. Meaning that sometimes things take time to come up with answers. You should be patient. Not every question has an answer. God has made more questions than answers, as every yeshiva student knows. But this is, as long as we're patient with it, and we keep on searching, you know, you find answers. You find answers. There's a lot out there. So thank you again for this opportunity. Very, very special to be here. Very, very special. And old friends, and young friends. I'm sorry, friends from a long time ago, and it's great to see. It's so great to be here. It's such an honor and an unbelievable pleasure. So I have some books in the back. If you're interested. A little advertising over here. So they're cheaper for me than from some of the publishers. So if you're interested, you can come and take. So they are all 20 except the book on Yonah, which I co-authored with my son, which is 15. But the other books are 10. And the book that I have that talks about these open miracles and issues about Hashem, that's called Reason to Believe: Rational Explanation of Orthodox.